We began the journey of this retreat with the theme of stability, well-being, and confidence, all of which are meant to support our ability to have insight into what's often called the three characteristics: impermanence, suffering, and not self. So yesterday, Matthew talked about suffering, and today I'll talk about what's usually called in English impermanence. This topic has such a central role in Buddhism and the teachings of the Buddha that you could almost say that, or you could say that everything that kind of is included within this topic, or this is that the central organizing principle for finding the path of practice and discovering liberation. And so to have a rich relationship with the world of change, of impermanence, to be able to over time, maybe over years and decades, kind of begin to appreciate all the many aspects of change and impermanence and different dimensions of it, is one of the ways that brings a wise life and a liberated life. It used to be, I think, that for some people, the word impermanence is a bit a daunting word. It's kind of a big word because it's understood, or it's taken to imply, that all things will pass. Things are impermanent means not going to be here forever. And mountains are impermanent because sooner or later, probably later from our perspective, they won't be here anymore. And if that's all that impermanence is, it's could be a little bit depressive. We're focusing only on the loss of things. And some people will like to say, well, yes, there's loss, but there's also every time something ends, it allows for a new beginning. And I've known of school teachers, elementary school teachers, who will teach the cycles of death and renewal by taking kids into the forest, and they see the leaves that fall, and those leaves become compost, decompose, become nutriments for the growth of life the next spring. So the idea that death is also an opportunity for something new to happen. Most of us aren't so eager to be that opportunity for something else. Some people find it valuable to see themselves as an opportunity, that their death as an opportunity, and so they'll offer their bodies in ways that can be recycled in a nice way. After all, our bodies are made up of 100% recycled material. And then when we die, the recycled material will get recycled into something again, over and over again. And so some people, the idea of impermanence, some people are, on principle, can just be sad by the idea. Some people, on principle, are delighted with the idea. They can't wait for things to be different than they are now. Can't things end sooner? Can't the retreat end sooner? This sitting, you know, I wish it was impermanent. This, you know. So there's, you know, there's loss and there's gain in this the world of life and death. that because things change in this world, there's another dimension which is important that Buddhism emphasizes, and that is that things don't exist independently, but rather when things exist in impermanent changing way, it's not chaos, it's not random how things are impermanent. But because things are in relationship to other things, the change is conditional in nature. Certain conditions come into play, and that affects how things unfold and the patterns and the way things go. And so we have family dynamics that can go on for generations. People are abusive in a family, and that abuse is passed on to the next generation and the next generation. And often some people have this wonderful, I don't know if wonderful is the right word, but this way of replicating the conditions that they were familiar with. Because they're familiar with what they knew, they replicate them in the next generation, and it can go on and on. And so that change has a certain pattern and flow. Other people, there are people who make it their life mission to stop the patterns that have gone on. And so they conduct themselves in a different way in order to free themselves of the continuity of certain dysfunctional patterns. Because you can offer different conditions, and different conditions can set in motion different consequences. And so the sins of the father don't have to go for seven generations, whatever they say. So we can change the conditions. And Dharma practice has a lot to do with shifting and changing conditions. We don't have to be the victims of causes and conditions, but we are participants in creating conditions or for certain things to unfold in the ways that are more useful and beneficial. And to have some wisdom and care around putting in place conditions that are onward leading for our benefit is only possible because things change. And we have to support or guide or, you know, best we can, the conditions that are supportive for ourselves and our society. And so one example that's obvious here, I think, we all put together the conditions for this retreat. We could have decided to meditated for the week on Times Square, Union Square in San Francisco. They say that practice can be done anywhere. And mature practitioners should, you know, practice any place and everywhere. So we should, next time we'll do the retreat in Union Square, Market Street. We'll just line up a long line on the sidewalk. And it'll be great. But chances are for most of us that those conditions aren't so optimal for some of the work, some of the great dedication, some of the things we've been dealing with, working with here in this retreat. And but the conditions here, we create conditions of stillness, silence, not a lot of activity, not a lot of input from outside. And so it allows for kind of settling and kind of meeting ourselves and connecting with aspects of ourselves that some people don't connect to for, you know, maybe they've ever connected to. And then we meet it with being ethical, we meet it with being, hopefully with some degree of kindness, we meet it with some degree of feeling we're supported. And these are all, you know, these are all conditions that are supporting the heart, the mind to unfold and to open up and to feel safe and to understand what's going on in a deeper way. And as those conditions come into play, other things happen in the wake of that and follow up on that. So Dharma practice has a lot to do with working with the condition, the changing nature of life, and putting into together the conditions that allow for beneficial change. You can't, in the idea of conditions, putting in conditions means that you can't force it. The Buddha very seldomly used the language of cause. So it isn't so much that we're causing, but we're supporting change. We're creating conditions for change. And this kind of takes us as the agent of change out of the picture, which is kind of a relief. But we still have an important role. We're not, you know, we can't just kind of do nothing. So there's a change of loss, the change of gain. There's the understanding the rich world of conditionality and interdependence that is there with all the changes we go on. And some people find it very, very meaningful to start seeing how interdependent and interconnected this conditional world is. And then there's a third, then a fourth kind of aspect of this of change, and that is the inconstancy of our experience. And in fact, the Pali word that's usually translated as impermanent, anicca, not nitya, is more literally translated as inconstancy instead of impermanence. And if impermanence implies that something comes to an end, the death of something that is finished, inconstancy doesn't quite have that same idea. Inconstancy means it's inconstant, means it's coming and going. And so the sun at the end of the day sets. It doesn't disappear once and for all. It doesn't die. We say it arises the next day. And it's in sunlight is inconstant. It comes and goes and comes and goes. Lunch is inconstant. It's not impermanent. It's not like it's, you know, I guess an individual lunch is impermanent. You know, comes to an end, but suppose. But, you know, lunch keeps reappearing. I've been on retreats where, usually longer retreats, I'm kind of settled into the rhythm of the retreat. And I get this feeling that all we ever do is eat. What? Another meal just arrived? I just finished breakfast and I ordered this lunch. Somehow, you know, you lose certain perspective or different perspective on retreat sometimes. And this idea of inconstancy, things arise and they pass. And so this same experience can come and go and come and go. And this coming and going of experience that is part of the richness that can also, this world of impermanence, and has tremendous value in Vipassana practice, not to see the impermanence, but to see the inconstancy of things. I'll get to that, explain a little bit more. So I want to tell a little story, Zen koan, and if I'm able to follow the path of this talk, the journey of this talk properly, I'll tell the story again. So we'll see, maybe, well, I can't promise, but. So it's a simple story of a Zen student who comes to Zen teacher and says, what do we do when the 10,000 things arise and pass all at the same time? So what do we do when there's sitting in the middle of just constant change and things coming and going, arising and passing, and it seems like everything, 10,000 things, kind of means seemingly everything is changing and shifting. What then? And the Zen teacher replies, whose arising and passing is it? And that's the end of the story. So whose arising and passing is it? What the Zen teacher is doing is pointing the person back to the subjective agent sense of being the perceiver of the arising and passing. And if a person, and probably this person was living in the monastery, was pretty settled and maybe deep in his practice, And in that kind of situations, if you turn around and look back, you won't find a perceiver. You won't find that which receives the arising and passing. Everything is arising and passing, including perception. So he was pointing the person back to an experience which is liberating. There's a kind of space and freedom to be found when you don't find the perceiver, the one who's experiencing it. But that's difficult to come to, but that's kind of the story I want to repeat if I can. But one of the reason I want to tell this story is that the teacher points the student back into him or herself, into the subjective world, into here, really here. And to be able to really settle back and really be here in a powerful, subjective, full way here is a task of a lifetime. It's a great thing to do. It's part of the path we're on. And in this regard, in the modern world, Theravadan world, they talk about the three characteristics. Sometimes people say the three characteristics of reality. Three things that characterize the world is impermanence, suffering, and not-self. And when I heard these talks in Burma over and over again, I was a bit perplexed. I could understand that things were impermanent, and I could kind of understand that things were not-self, but everything is suffering? The way it was presented to me is like, that didn't make sense, because the mountain is not suffering. The bell here is not suffering. How could that? The bell's not mine. The bell is impermanent. But how could that be suffering? But it was presented as if we were talking about the nature of reality. The three characteristics. However, what's I think fascinating is the Buddha himself never called these three things the three characteristics. What the Buddha called them was the three perceptions. Or another way I like to call it, three perspectives. Buddha wasn't so much interested in what's out there, but rather what's here, which is the perception. Perception is something that we do. And in fact, perspective is kind of a nice term, because many times when we think of the word perception, we think we're innocent. I'm just perceiving how things are. You know, I'm just minding my own business, and I just seeing things, you know, exactly as they are. We're not innocent. We're constantly constructing, conceiving. The sense data that comes in, prioritizing, organizing, projecting, interpreting, the act of perceiving is a fairly complicated phenomenon. And so the Buddha is pointing back to this idea of perception, how we perceive. And we can have the perception of impermanence, the perception of suffering, the perception of not-self. Some people might think it's a subtle distinction, but it's just kind of coming back, being here, and not being pulled out into the world to make conclusions about the world out there, which, you know, you can if you want to do that, but that's not how you're going to get liberated, by making conclusions about what's out there. You want to come in, come back here. So, a person, maybe you, person is walking down Market Street in San Francisco, the busy lunchtime day, and there's lots of people out there all going to work or going someplace important, and everybody's, you know, and the sidewalks are packed with people, and you're in a real hurry. It's important to get to where you're going. There's a lot of people who are the obstacles. Those people are just obstacles. That's a perception. They're obstacles. That's a perspective. That's a projection. You know, they're obstacles only because you need to get somewhere. But they're obstacles, and you're dodging around them and going around and you're kind of serious, and you're only thinking about how to weave your way through and get someplace, and your mind is completely consumed with this task at hand, and you don't ever notice any faces of the people. Sometimes people are either obstacles or they're instrumental to help you. You get behind the people who are really strong, big, and kind of forcing their way through, and you just kind of like ride behind their tail. And then it's maybe at some point you look down for some reason, you notice your shoelace is untied. So you step to the side and you tie your shoe and you stand up and you look around. Wow, look at all this movement. Look at all these people scurrying around. Look, they're all like so preoccupied getting somewhere. There's no one smiling. No one's looking at each other. Everyone seems to be dodging each other and around, and it's like so much movement and activity. I had no idea. I hadn't stopped to think about it. And just a few minutes ago, I was in that. But now I'm on the side and I can see it. Boy, what a different perspective this is, to see the coming and going of people and how they are. And in fact, now that I'm here, standing here, I'm actually kind of tired. Maybe I go sit on the little bench over there. So you sit on the bench, and it occurs to you, you're sitting there, and you say, wow, my mind. Before I was kind of racing, looking and getting and wanting and looking for those gaps. My mind was so busy figuring out how to walk so quickly. I'm not doing that now, but I can feel the leftover momentum of my mind. And my mind is thinking about this and that and trying to get there and wondering what's going to happen at the meeting and just like flittering around. It's so busy. It's so active. But because you're sitting still, you can see that. So first you're standing still. You can see the movement you didn't really was there, but you weren't really taking in. Because you're sitting on the bench, you see the movement in your mind jumping from one thought to the other. Wow, look at that. So you say, this is a lot of busy mind. There must be a better way to have such a busy mind. I'll go on a retreat. And in the future, they'll have little retreat centers at every block. So you just slip in to the retreat center there and sit down. And after some days, you feel so much more settled in your body. And you're kind of like, you sit down, and you just feel like you're really here. You're kind of like a mountain. Boom, I'm sitting down. Stable and strong, and after a while, and the more stable you are, you notice, and all this discursive thoughts, these conversations you had, these plannings for meetings, it's quieted down, and the mind itself becomes stiller and quieter. And then you notice that there keeps being this drive to want to hold on to thoughts. You're not exactly having conversations in your head anymore, but just like grabbing onto thoughts, wanting thoughts, pumping out thoughts. The mind is still like a little popcorn maker of thoughts. And you had no idea that underneath all those discursive plans and ideas that you had, there was this kind of movement of wanting and grabbing and pushing away and fixing and adjusting that the mind was doing. So you've heard about how nice it is to just settle into the breathing. So you decide to follow your breathing for a while. And as you do that, the mind gets quieter and stiller. And then, the windows are open. And so then you hear, your senses are attuned and you're more present than usual. And there's this beautiful bird outside that's chirping. But you're settling in and getting so concentrated, so quiet, that bird is actually a disturbance. Like you were on the brink of something getting getting absorbed. And so you're the bird, you know, why did they open the window? I think I'm going to need to write to the director of IRC and say, you know, we need to keep the windows closed because that supports concentration. And you start, composing this letter and about how important that bird sounds are a real problem and how they're a problem. And, you know, you even have to think out that you really kind of, you want to make a real impression in this letter. So you spend some time really considering what notes the bird is playing, why these particular notes are particularly difficult for meditation. And you really do a good job, this letter you're composing. And well, the bird has flown away a long time ago. It was impermanent, the sound was impermanent, the sound's long gone. The permanence was created, that this permanent bird sound was created in your mind, how it holds on to it. There's a paradox that the more the mind is busy, the more the mind is constructing and thinking about things, the more it tends to perceive or construct or kind of relate to the world in terms of things are more constant than they are. That bird sound, it's still there in the mind, even though it's long gone in reality. And many of our concerns and our worries we have are not about what's happening here and now in the moment of experience, but belongs to this conceptual world of ideas and memories and projections and plans. And there's the nature of ideas can so easily fool us into this idea that things are more permanent than they are, more constant than they are. But if we stay if we really settle back here, we start discovering something fascinating and very important. And that is that when we don't overlay the ideas, stories, concepts on things, on direct experiences, what we perceive is that there's a shifting and changing of phenomena. There's the bird sound. And we're aware of the bird sound a little bit, and then someone rustles in the hall, we're aware of that, and then there's an itch, and we're aware of the itch, and then we're aware of the breathing, and oh, it's nice, it's nice to be with the breathing. But then after a little while, we're aware that it's warm in the air. Why am I so warm? There's a thought, should I take off my jacket? But we don't do anything, and the thought, poof, vanishes, and then there's the feeling of the butt against the cushion. And then there's a bird sound again. But this sound, the bird sound, is not seen as a solid sound, but you notice that there's gaps in the chirps. Look, it's little chirps come and go. And then I'm back with my breathing. And the breathing is a series of phenomena that come and go. There's all these sensations that the in-breath comes and goes, comes back, comes and goes. The out-breath comes and goes. The sensations that make up the in-breath come and go, the little pieces of it. And, and the hardness of the zafu against the butt, it's one way with the world of ideas and concepts and reacting to it, it has a certain permanence. But if I'm not reacting to it or thinking about it so much, really feel the details of it, it's actually made up of all these little points of sensation that are dancing and coming and going. There's some kind of magical inconstancy within it that is only seen if we stop overlaying the concept idea, relate to it a certain way. So the path that we followed here is a path of being on this busy sidewalk, and being so caught up in the walking in the world out there, we don't even think about or concerned about anything but what we're doing. We don't really see or think about that we're, you know, even that how busy everything is. But if we stand still, we have a different perspective of what's happening on the street. If we sit down and become even stiller, it might give us a perspective of what's going on in the mind. If we sit down and meditate, for a while, we we get more stability and stillness. And we see different ways. And if we get really still, and so the conceptualizing mind, the thinking mind, the projecting mind, the reactive mind, the mind that's for and against experience, has gotten still, then we see the radical experience of the 10,000 things arising and passing all at once. That we're actually living in a world that's very different than what we construct if we relax and settle down. We have a different perspective on this world we have. And having a different perspective can be useful. And to realize that our usual perspectives we have are valuable in a certain situation, but they're only, you know, they're kind of provisional. So, for example, if we go down here to the beach in the late afternoon, we can stand there and admire the sunset. The sun is setting over the ocean. And then you might say, wow, look at that. The sun is setting. It's heading, so kind of see it settling. It's kind of slow, kind of. The sun is probably very mindful because it's going down slow. And it's very nice. But the sun is not setting. We're standing there hurtling backward through space. And we're like, you know, we're like, you know, we're going like thousands and thousands and thousands of miles an hour through space, spinning. And we're hurtling through space with something that doesn't have any brakes. And we're spinning backwards. And it's because we're spinning backwards, it looks like the sun is setting. But the sun is, related to us, is not going anywhere. What's that make you, does it make you kind of dizzy? The fact that, you know, you're actually spinning backwards? That's what's more of what's going on. So our perceptions of things. You know, we have one idea. So to settle. So what I'm trying to point out here is that the more stable we get, still we get, that it opens up a new perspective for seeing what our nature of our experiences, what the immediacy, the subjective experience, the building blocks, the origin of it all. There's a Buddhist idea that the whole world begins each moment. And the whole world begins here in you. In fact, the Buddha used the word world. Pali word is loka, to refer to what's here in this body and mind. The whole world is here. And of course we know it can't be all here, but the physical world and everything that. But the world of your experience can be nowhere else. Your experience of the world is born, arises, and passes here. And to settle back into this immediacy of our world here, to settle into have the stillness and stability, opens us to a new perspective. A perspective that's, so these three characteristics are really the three perspectives. And it allows us to see below or without the lenses of concepts, ideas, and without a lot of the baggage we have when it's me, myself, and mine, that goes into almost everything we think about and relate to. How does it relate to me, and what does it do for me? The stilling and quieting of these activity of the mind. Trusting that it's okay to not be searching, not be defending, not be explaining, not be apologizing, not be fantasizing. It's okay to let this whole, for a while, to let the mind become still and quiet. So all those ideas don't get in the way of our perception. And then at some point, the paradox is It's kind of a paradox that the more agitated and busy the mind is, the more there's a delusion of permanence, the more we think things are permanent. And that's partly because when the more busy the mind is, the more it's operating in the world of ideas. The more still the mind is, the more we see impermanence, change, and constancy. So there's wonderful kind of mutual supportive relationship with becoming stable, still, that allows us to see change. And why should we? Why is this so important, and why does Buddhism emphasize this so much? If you see and experience things changing, the changing flow of phenomena, the arising in constancy, how things come and go and arise and pass, the flow of our experience, you'll become much more sensitive to how we resist that change, or how we try to hold on to prevent change, or how we try to run away from change, or how we try to chase after change. We have all these relationships to this world that are hard to see, but there's something about seeing the inconstancy of the rising and passing of phenomena that allows us to see what we're doing. I liken it to being next to a river, and we're watching the river flow. The way that's the nature of the river. It just flows and flows and flows and flows. And then you have a bucket, and you dip your bucket into the river. You get a bucket of water. And then you go up and find some people and say, "Look, I have the river here." And it's heavy, a lot of work to carry this bucket. And you give it to someone else, say, "Here, you keep the river." And they have to carry your river for a long time. That's not the river. There's something about, we've lost the flow, we've lost the change, we've stepped out of it, away from it, holding on to something. So there's something about seeing the flow and the change. We see what the mind, the tricks of the mind, what it does. And one of the things we start seeing is much more acutely is the movements of clinging, of grasping, of holding, of resisting. And grasping, holding, resisting also is one of those things that supports the delusion of permanence. Because there is a kind of constancy, you know, if you hold on to something for a little while, it's not changing. And so you kind of supports the idea, well, things are kind of fixed, or, you know, some kind of way. But to see, really, part of the function of this practice is to really see clearly the clinging, the grasping, the clutching that the mind does, that the body does, the heart does. And then, but if we keep seeing the changing constant nature, what happens is we realize it doesn't make sense to hold on. This is exhausting. The track record of success and clinging has been poor. I guess I've been doing this my whole life. And what, you know, maybe so occasionally it's been useful. But I think, you know, probably if you do the run the numbers about, you know, how often it was useful and how often was a waste of time, I suspect that there's much more waste of time. Don't defend clutching because the few times that it was useful, you know, like, be loyal to it. It's exhausting, limiting, painful. And so both seeing the cost of it, that for some people is enough to begin experimenting, trying to release the grip, to soften the hold. And it can kind of feel like a very natural movement to just, it's exhausting, you know, to release the effort, the work of clutching and holding. The other thing that the seeing and constancy arising and passing does is that it is a wonderful, I think a wonderful, I'm kind of very amused by this, but maybe you won't be amused. Maybe you'll cry or something, protest. Is that, you know, if you, we all know there's air here in this room, oxygen and air, and we depend on it, it's such an important thing for our life. If we sucked all the air out of this room, we wouldn't last very long. We'd notice pretty quickly. So it's important. It's important for our life. So given how important it is, we better grab it. And you know, I keep grabbing, but I come up with nothing. You know, air doesn't lend itself to be grabbed. Grabbing a bunch of water, it just squeezes out, and very little is left. It turns out that we can't really, when we grab and clutch and resist, we don't really do it. It's a little bit of an illusion. When you really settle into the experience, the flow and the immediacy of the moment. And that's a powerful lesson. And the thing you might protest by is my idea that the only thing, unless you're kind of holding onto the ladder, climbing up, the only thing we ever cling to are ideas, concepts. If you're clinging to what you think we should have for lunch, that's your idea of lunch. If you're looking at the dessert cookie and hoping there's still, you know, you've washed your hands, you stood in line, and you see the cookie, and there's not too many left, and there's all these people in front of you, and you really want the cookie, and you're like, boy, your mind is like fixated on the cookie and calculating how many people, and oh no, that person took two, and you know, you're not really attached to the cookie. It's your idea of the cookie and the idea of what the cookie will do for you. If you were really, truly clutching the cookie, you'd have cookie crumbs. So it's fascinating, and it's a little bit unnerving, it's a little bit humbling, it's a little bit embarrassing, that when we cling, all these things we cling to, we're not actually clinging to them, we're clinging to the ideas of them. And so to see, you know, so the mind to slowly begin to understand that clinging doesn't really work, and the cost of it, and then to begin to relax, to soften, and this movement of the heart to relax, the mind to soften, to not be trying and working and being driven, and is a wonderful thing. To not be, the mind not to be dependent on chasing things or wanting things to be a certain way. To have the mind to start to become independent of causes and conditions. Mind to become independent of all those people walking up and down the sidewalk. Not, you know, caught in the traffic. To become independent of all the thoughts that come and go. They come and go, but we're independent of them. They come and go. To become independent of our perceptions. There's a freedom there. And one of the freedoms that we can discover, one thing that we can discover, is that the ideas, the feelings, the intuitions that we have about the self as the perceiver, as the agent, as the victim, as the receiver, as the central clearinghouse, as the subject of it all, that when we really still and quiet, and not kind of seeing through ideas, there's nothing that really qualifies, nothing we can find that makes sense to be that agent, to be that perceiver, to be that and in not seeing it, that's there's space for us to breathe, space for us to breathe freely, space for us to be free. But to use a pronoun us kind of doesn't make sense. There's space for freedom. There's space for a radical experience of non-clinging, non-clutching, where it doesn't make sense to talk about I'm not clutching. It's kind of like you held your hand in a fist for a long time, and then you open your fist, it feels so good that you grab onto it to have more of it. But that doesn't work. And you know, you lose the very thing that you have, you know, the very thing that by clutching, you lose the very thing which is the unclutching. So to soften the clutch of self, and to have a way for the heart, the mind to be, without reclutching onto self. So to have well-being, to have confidence, to sit here, stable, still, strong, to really be where the conditions of solid stability, just here, fully here, unquestionably here in our experience, and to settle in and relax in and to this experience. And then the student goes to the Zen master and says, what do I do when the 10,000 things are arising and passing at the same time? And the Zen master says, whose arising and passing is it? And that story, with that story came to an end. And I suspect that it was a wonderful beginning for that student, something new arose, a wonderful new life. So maybe something here at this retreat, some story for you can come to an end, be put down, or be lessened, so that there can be a new beginning, something new and wonderful can arise for you. And perhaps one of the wonderful possibilities is that you can be happy. Just being ordinary. Just being here, breathing and walking and eating, and that just to be alive is enough. Maybe we should try it. Just here. Simple, ordinary breathing.